This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
There we are, it's City Limits again, and it's 9 o'clock. We're actually starting on time. This is incredible. And Maxwell's over there pressing the buttons, making sure we do start on time. I'm Kevin Healy. And
Good morning.
And budget last night, of course.
Yes.
You run a program about finance and economy on this program, station. Comment on the budget. Pretty thrilled, I suppose, are you? Working class saved again.
Reminded of that Paul Keating thing about being flogged to death with a wet lettuce.
Oh, right.
I mean, you know, I don't know. Sometimes I think incrementalism might work if you can put the wedge in and wedge it open, but sometimes you just think, oh, it's just not enough.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's right. That's your summary of the budget.
That's my summary of the budget. A bit of a groan and a moan, basically.
Okay, well, today's program, by the way, it's the second Wednesday we're doing energy type issues, and we're going to be talking to the energy person from Australian Conservation Foundation, Freya Leonard, later in the program. So we'll be talking about lots of stuff, and I'm sure she'll have some comments on the budget. I notice it has put aside a lot of money to put more pollution fossils into the economy, so that's great to know. A cup of tea, Anne.
I think that's what's needed, Kevin, at this point.
Now, you've got a choice of a mug with these flowers that says, here's to the moments that turned into memories with friends that have turned into family. I'm glad to have a friend like you by my side, it says here. And the other one is, don't be a mug, join the union today. So,
I have the Hallmark one?
Okay, you want this? You the want Hallmark the friend, mug. The friendly one?
Oh, the
with
friendly
the flowers.
One. Yes, with
right
the flowers.
Here. I'm not being a mug. Now, listen, you'll be pleased to know that after the by-election last weekend, in a gloating celebratory column on Monday, that wonderful giant mind of Rupert Murdoch's empire, Andrew bolt through the head. Andrew said, and the party of the working class is coming for both Liberal and Labor. So you'll be pleased to know that when we thought they were some right-wing extreme group, one notion is actually the party of the working class. Yes.
Well, we're in good hands there, aren't we?
Isn't that great news?
Oh. I guess.
A sip of tea there. Now, here's one that... Here's one that is going to test you. You've got to make a choice here. Currently there's a battle on for who becomes federal president of the Liberal Party, though I would thought at the moment there'd be no one wanting the job at all. I would have thought they'd be running away saying, we don't want it, you know, go away. But
doesn't
anyway.
Look good on your resume.
No, it looks like it's coming down to a choice between, and this is where I'm asking you to, and this is a pretty tough one. I'll give you a bit of time to think about this one.
Okay.
These are the two people who will likely be running, and who do you think you'd barrack for in this case? Tony Abbott or Alexander Downer? Now, come on, you've got a choice here. If the shaking pen over the ballot paper, which way would it go?
That reminds me of that game you play as kids. You go, would you rather drown or be burned to death? I don't know. Maybe they could share the position.
that's opting out. Now, that's unfair. You've got to vote for one of them. That's it. Okay, you've given up.
What an unfair question.
No, well, I thought it was a good question. Abbott or Downer. Now,
which ego will be inflated the least?
It's touch and go, isn't it? I mean, they'll probably sort it out somehow, and only one more, I don't know. But anyway, does it matter? It's irrelevant. But I just thought it was an interesting choice with the pen over the paper, though.
Yeah.
There's a new book coming out, so I want you to set July 28 aside because you'll be rushing to the nearest bookshop to get it. It's called Riding the Jet Stream. It's called Riding the Jet Stream. Mm-hmm. July 28th, the big release date. It's the tell-all book from Alan Joyce, the former, yes, former airline that used to be our airline head. And it says that, it's a great book, really. It's a chance for the businessman to set the record straight after a turbulent end to his time at the airline. Well, it certainly was. Mm. An instructive read for future leaders, it says. Mm. And that's us, so we need to lead. So there you go. But the bit I really like is that it says it's a story of, quote, ambition, intellect and steel. Anne, you got that wrong. I can see where your head went immediately. Uh-huh. No, I want to assure you, steel is spelled S-T-E-E-L. No, that's definitely...
I'm glad you clarified that, Kevin.
You were jumping to conclusions then, weren't you?
I would have jumped to that conclusion.
You jumped to conclusions then, but no. Anyway, that's the big date, listeners. Get out there July 28th, get the bookstore and get onto Alan's book. It should be a must...
Once you got the Fin Review must read on that one.
Must read. Now, up in Queensland, of course, we know they've got the Olympic Games coming up. And it's been recently. I won't go into the names, and it what's it matter anyway. But mm-hmm. They recently discovered that a couple of their ministers, their Olympics minister and their child safety minister, are having an affair. Isn't that unusual? I mean, how incredible, people having an affair.
All those late nights in the office.
Who would have thought?
Okay.
Another sip. Yeah, who would have thought? But the interesting thing is that. They've switched the sailing events from where they're originally going to be held to the Whitsundays, which happens to be the electorate of the child safety minister with whom the Olympics minister is having an affair.
Oh.
But there's no conflict of interest, they say, because at the time they were between, they had the affair, they broke off and they started again. But it was the break-off period when it happened, so it's all okay. So I just wanted to clear that one up.
They had reunion grifting, did they?
Yeah, whatever happened. He'd been married to someone for years, by the way. But that's beside the point. Everyone has affairs, don't they? I thought interesting that no conflict of interest in moving it to her electorate.
No pillow talk involved.
No, none of that stuff. Probably too busy doing other things, but anyway, the this one is not to be laughed at. Mm. With the Iran war on, and we know every year you have the low wage case, the lowest of low wage minimum wage case, and it's due to come up. It's due again in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And the ACTU's put forward a proposal for 5%, but they're now saying because of the situation that's been created by the war, they might have to up their because inflation's going higher than they thought and everything else.
The
Council of Small Business Organisations says because of the uncertainty caused by the war, the minimum wage rise case should be put off altogether. not put off altogether, but put off till much later in the year when it's more certainty of what's happening to the economy. So in fact, they're arguing, and it's going before the Fair Work Commission to consider that in fact they delay the thing and put it back till the end of the year sometime. And they say to December the 1st they want to put it off for half a year, which gives them half a year extra of the extra of not having to pay the extra.
This is a very different kind of wartime economy from what we would have had in World War II, et cetera, when they were putting caps on company profits. And so rather than do that, we really should make sure that minimum wage doesn't go up.
Oh, that's right, that's right. We can't put caps on profit, for God's sake. I mean, the war is a great way of making profit.
True.
Now, also, the NAB, the I think it's a great name for a bank, isn't it, NAB? Nab Your Money, yes. Bank. Nab Your Money.
You don't even have to change that one,
no, that's
do you?
Right. You just Nab Your Money. Anyway, they managed to, they've now decided they're going to hire 1,500 people in Asia, in Vietnam and India. Isn't mm-hmm. that wonderful?
Okay.
Yeah. So they're, but that might mean they might have to lay off people in Australia, which is a bit of a problem. Yeah, they've already, in fact, done that. They cut 400 jobs in September last year, and 170 more jobs in March this year. But now they're putting on 1,500 extra workers in Vietnam and India. I'm sure they'll pay them massive rates, of course. Of course they will.
Of course, this is wouldn't be a bottom line consideration.
No. And asked why they were doing this, Nab Your Money said, for some time, the building a modern workforce that best supports our customers is an important part of our strategy. Our workforce continues to evolve to ensure we can help customers more consistently at the times they need us and to help us access great talent in key markets. So apparently you can help customers more consistently if you're in Vietnam or India.
You know, I was up at 3 a.m. the other day needing to move my assets around globally.
That's right.
It's good to know I can do that 24/7.
Well, Nab's your chance.
No, that's, yes, I appreciate you, Nab.
Yeah, that's right. So that's they're doing that. And, you have to wonder if lower wages are the cause, but they wouldn't be. I mean,
No.
It's what they want to do best for customers.
How could you even suggest that?
Leapt to some terrible conclusion there. Oh. Now, also last week, of course, the RBA, the Reserve Bank, whacked up again, and Michelle Bullock said, "Well, you know the economy's power are important than making the poor poorer." I think that's basically what she was saying. A day or two before, and this is great news, the fund managers, those who invest money for people and tell them how to make money, mm-hmm. were giving people all sorts of advice on how to make lots of money, who would be the biggest winners when the rates went up.
Okay.
So isn't it great to know that some people were making a lot of money out of it, while people with mortgages and others are paying a lot more. But nonetheless, there are winners as long as you have the right fund manager to tell you how to win, isn't it? Isn't that good news?
The thing that I really can't understand about this is, okay, so we might be seeing a bit of inflation due to energy prices going up, which I'm sure we'll be talking about soon, due to a war over near Iran. So in order to manage that, we just need to make sure that people who have mortgages have more trouble paying their mortgage.
Yeah.
What is the connection?
Well, in fact, also, if they're worried about inflation and if putting interest rates up mean people have to pay more for their mortgage, isn't that inflation in itself?
Mm. Yeah. In fact, it is a thing that the there's a big debate amongst the economists as to whether it's actually inflationary or anti-inflationary, and there's no clear answer on it. So they're using an old economic model to make stupid decisions.
And they seem to have only one solution to the problem all the time.
They've only got a hammer, so everything's a nail, right?
Yeah. Mm. So, but anyway, they're doing a good job of it. They're,
sack the board, I say.
Yeah. Oh, what? What? Oh, come on.
Not that Jim's listening to me.
Well, of course, they also say, well, there were two things came out in the past, and they still say unemployment isn't high enough.
Yes.
So because if it's...
That's another reason to put up.
If there's more unemployment, there's less money to spend, so that controls inflation as well.
Right.
So that's great. And last week she also said that the government spending on the needy is causing problems for the economy as well. That's
right. The so-called independent central bank, which is never independent, telling the government how to manage the economy.
That's
it's,
right.
It's so rude.
It's got to spend less on the needy.
Yes.
Because that's also giving them money to spend, which helps inflation. So, you know, no one suggests that maybe the boss is putting up their prices as part of inflation, is it?
Nobody suggests that. And nobody suggests that maybe we could be subsidising services while we've got this energy blip happening. But anyway.
Good heavens, what was that? Did I hear correctly?
Michelle just like leapt into the air then.
Oh dear me, I'm going to pop up. Do you want a bit of top up? Are you going okay?
Oh no, I'm going well, thank you.
Well, you just missed out anyway because that's the end of it.
Oh.
Yeah, we just a few drops came out and that was it.
Is there only like two cups worth in there?
Yeah, I should put more in, I suppose, or maybe more tea. Now, also... last week, the Rush, is her name Rushworth, whatever her name is, the Amanda Rishworth, anyway, she's the Industrial Relations Minister. I keep forgetting her name.
What a name for a little kid to grow up with.
Yeah, she's not
we're
worth
having
much.
Trouble.
But anyway, she assured that she was actually speaking at a conference of AI executives and AI industry and the practitioners, and she assured them that the government would not bring in follow the union desires to have some say in how it affects workers. You know, the workers want a right of veto over some things in AI. But anyway, she assured the practitioners that no, don't panic, because we're not going to, you know, give your workers a say over how it's going to affect their lives, which I thought was pretty good.
Well, just remember, they're no longer the party of workers. We've got one nation.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's it. It's now the party of the working class. That's Pauline Hanson. Well, she's lumping.
She'll get it in there and bat for us.
I suppose she could grow out of his lump and prol anyway, but perhaps not quite working class. You'll also be pleased to know that, and I was going to see what Amanda might do about this, the union, the Tertiary Education Union, claims that at Deakin here in Victoria, they claim that the Deakin University's relentless pursuit of profit has created a dangerous, toxic workplace marked by systemic wage theft and extreme workloads for staff. Who would believe that? I mean, yes, that's right.
I can't believe the profit motive would undermine our educational institutions.
No. And they claim that it's a dangerous place to work. Now, they say bullying, isolation and workload overload and they can't challenge management, and it's become a health and safety risk for staff. It's a sick place to work, and its impact on staff ultimately reflects upon the experience of students. And goes on. But the union itself said, not the union, the university categorically denied this, by the way.
Okay.
So make it does put a lie to what the union says, because they said staff are actively encouraged to raise concerns and the claim that they face pressure or retaliation for doing so is false. So there you are. And we're encouraging them to raise concerns. Well, they have raised concerns, so that's good. They've taken up the offer. But I thought, if it comes down to a choice between the union and the university, which side would Amanda jump on in this case? Because she's the Industrial Relations Minister in a socialist government.
Which way would she go? Who would she vote for with her pen hovering
over
the page?
That's right. You're a bit like you having to choose between Tony Abbott and Alexander Downer.
She's got more of a choice, I think.
So there you are. But it is, I mean, seriously, it's pretty awful that the working loads in these situations. But
they need to properly fund our educational institutions universities.
You raised the point, of course, that how you made the satirical point about how, you know, they're all about education. Well, of course, John Howard was the one who commercialised them, and I still think the vice chancellors are to be condemned at that time, the Davises and company, particularly in the big universities, who just went along with it all the way and didn't stand up to it. It's a bit like, I think, back in 96 and co, when Work Choices was coming in, I think the union sort of stood up then and said, we're not going to cop this.
Mm-hmm. Because they've unleashed on us.
Yeah. And I think those vice chancellors have a lot to answer for, because they have turned it, you know, unfortunately, tertiary institutions into commercial enterprises, and all the consequent problems that that's created and is created.
They're not even serving the international students very well, you know, because they're promised this, you know, idea of getting a good education, and then they'll get this great paying job at the end of it, and then they end up having to work at Aldi's.
That's right. And well, and indeed, that, of course, bringing in HECS and everything else hasn't helped there. But, I mean, in an earlier life, campus life was so important. But now there's very little of it, because they're out working or, you know, trying to make a living.
Besides, it just undermines the whole culture of the institution. Anyway, they could fund them, as we say. The federal government can't run out of the dollars, and they really should be running a deficit so that they can fund everything properly. And that's for Friday.
And there was also a case last week where against a mob called Neo Metals.
Neo Metals.
An executive thought he was a whistleblower. Mm-hmm. It turns out they took him to court, the company, and the full federal court backed them, the decision to make him redundant, finding that because the board and CEO subjectively believed his complaints were unfounded, or it was simply part of his job to raise such matters, he was not protected by whistleblower laws. And this has now been interpreted as making whistleblowing almost impossible. And in fact, the Human Rights Law Centre says no whistleblower has been successful in a compensation claim under federal, public and private sector whistleblowing laws, and this decision will make it even more difficult. This judgment may allow employers to avoid liability by establishing that they subjectively did not consider the whistleblower to have sufficient grounds for their whistleblowing, or that they considered the wrongdoing was not serious enough to fall under the whistleblower law. That could undermine the practical effect of whistleblower protection. So it's a real blow.
Interesting.
Absolutely. And and you'd be surprised to know that Tabcorp is facing suggestions that there's a bit of money laundering going on. Yeah. I know that would surprise you.
Surprising me. Full of shocks.
That would surprise you, because poor old Gil McLachlan, of course, who moved from the AFL to Tabcorp, he was heading for Warrnambool for the big week of horses jumping over hurdles and steeples and things last week.
Okay.
And he had all his mates, Andrew Dillon, the current bloke, Martin Pakula, the ex-Labor minister, and now he's Formula One and everything else, and Carbines, the racing minister, all set to go up to Warrnambool together, and he got called into court to give evidence.
He ruined his weekend. How dare they?
Stuffed up his week.
I'm sure he hasn't got a lot to add about it.
Anyway. No, it's bloody terrible. Also, it's found out that two of the biggest law firms in America have been involved over 10 years of insider trading that netted millions and millions and millions of dollars in illicit profit. Who would believe that one as well?
They don't know their insider trading law very well,
No. Well, they do.
Or maybe they know it too well.
That might be the problem. I just thought, well, look, we'll finish up with this one, because then we'll go to... one other one I do want to raise.
Okay.
But the interesting comment last week, in the whole Iran thing, you know, it's on again, off again, and, you know, one minister, Marco, says this and Donald says that, and they all say different things every day. Mm-hmm. But we're pleased to know Pete Hegseth, that absolute giant mind... Mm. Who is the Minister for Secretary for War. Anyway, Pete said Now, Pete said, I can't believe it. Pete said, we're not looking for a fight.
I like your accent.
Yeah, we're not looking for a fight. Now, I would have thought that would carry a lot more weight if they hadn't started the fight in the first place.
Well, the Minister for War, what would you expect? He doesn't want a fight, he wants a war.
Oh, that's true. Okay, you've done it. That's
solved that one for you,
Kevin. That's solved that one for me. Thank you very much. You're clearing a few things up here. Yeah, we're clearing a few things up here today. Now, also in America, of course, coming up is the, across North America, Canada, the US and Mexico, is the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
Or football, as we're told, the soccer fans say call it football because it's football.
Right.
But New Jersey, where they've decided that the price of public transport to get to the match, because you've got to get public transport to it apparently, from the Penn Station to MetLife Stadium, where 8 games, including the final, will be played.
Mm-hmm.
The fare is usually $12.90 US or $18 Australian, but they've set it for the World Cup at $209.50 Australian. One to go to the thing, that's just for the fare. And apparently the price of tickets is just extraordinary.
Oh, wow.
Most people can't afford them.
We don't want the riffraff getting on that particular train.
No, we certainly don't. Anyway, it's $209.50 to go from
and
Penn Station.
And you complain about 5% inflation,
that's
Kevin.
That's right. Yeah, they say, well, they give some excuse why they have to do it, but I rather think the excuse is a bit ordinary.
Well, they have to, hose out the train at the end of the day.
Yes. So I just thought that was quite... And the other places are doing... Oh, a couple of places, in fact, they're not. I mean, a couple of... I can't think which they were, but there are a couple of cities where they're going to be games where they're just going on the normal public transport.
Okay.
But a lot of other places... But that's the most extreme version. But there's all... some other places are putting up the fares extraordinarily as well.
Wow.
Okay, well, that's that. We'll take a break, come back and talk to Freya Leonard and get some common sense into this program. Radio. Do you want to back announce whatever that was?
It was great. It was Don't Need to Be Cool by Ajak Kwai.
Right, it just faded away, but there you are. And on the line we have Freya Leonard, who's the energy spokesperson, energy campaigner with Australian Conservation Foundation. And Freya, just to kick off the budget last night, was there anything in there on energy that that was positive?
On balance, it was a mix of the good and the bad. Clearly, the fossil fuel lobbying that has been rolling out across Parliament in Australia, and you know, not least of which being federal Parliament, has landed well. But if you want to hear some good news, so, I mean, there was $7.2 billion over the forward estimates for the cheaper homes battery to continue. So that's a good thing. That's been incredibly popular, and there's been huge take-up nationally of home batteries as people recognise for financial and climate reasons that fossil fuels have to go. And they're adopting that at a, you know, household level, which is fantastic to see that increasing. The $500 million in the forward estimates for the Active Transport Fund supporting like bike lanes and other, you know, non-fossil transport is really great to see. However, $500 million will only get us so far, so it is kind of a drop in the ocean, but at least it's something. That cute little $4.5 million to accelerate the electrification of Aussie Post deliveries is kind of cute.
Mm-hmm.
But more significantly, you know, $1.2 billion for the Future Made in Australia, additional initiatives for clean energy manufacturing. So it's great to see that is continuing to be funded. And there's a focus on resilient metals production, that's sort of like low-carbon metals production. $250 million for the national EPA. And then most significantly, $110.8 million to continue protecting Australia's native species over the next 2 years. So there was some good news, at least, for climate, nature, energy. However, it's the worst part of the job is having to say however at the end of the good news.
Yes, that's right.
And here we are. And here we continue to be. So all of that kind of combined comes to around $50 billion of good news. But in terms of fossil fuel support, we're looking at something more in the order of $72.4 billion. And that's a bunch of bad ideas, including subsidising liquid fossil fuel use, like fertiliser, for instance, and fuel. $46.2 billion over the forward estimates for the fuel tax credit scheme, and that basically goes straight to multinational miners like BHP, Glencore, to get their diesel tax-free. That's a real backward step. That I have great concerns about, Kevin, because it's been a point of contention for a long time. But as the everything's kicked off in the Middle East and the Strait of Hormuz has throttled back supplies, there's been more buzz in the mining industry about electrifying their fleet. This subsidy is going to disincentivise that. So really disappointed to see such an enormous amount of money to keep us back in the dark ages of fossil fuel use.
Yeah. But as a by the by, Tim Ayres, that department you mentioned about the money going to the keeping the Australian manufacturing area, so much of the money that's gone already on that campaign has gone to people like Rio Tinto and Glencore, these big international companies, to keep smelters and things going. It seems to be, you know, massive subsidisation of these international corporations.
Well, indeed. And that is very much a prevalent theme across this budget. So a lot of people are talking about the negative gearing reforms, and rightly so, and it's something that has been, you know, buzzing around federal policy for a long time. There's been, you know, certainly Scott Ludlam was asking for that for the Greens years ago, and at that point Labor outright refused. So, you know, it's great to see that is finally being tackled, but it has eclipsed some of the gnarlier decisions in this budget, which are particularly going to absolutely benefit big business over households. And yeah, so your analysis is absolutely spot on, Kevin, as always.
Gee, thanks. But also, just recently, there's been some interesting ads. I think full-page ads in the media. There was one: as doctors, we know that gas is a health hazard. Gas stoves and heaters make asthma worse. Gas extraction, etc. They go on about the problems of gas. That's sponsored by Doctors for the Environment and the Australia Institute. And last week, I erased on this program actually an ad. A full-page ad: Australia is at an energy crossroads, an open letter to the Australian government from former oil and gas professionals. Now, at this point, you think, oh, they're going to be supporting the industry, but in fact, they come out strongly against it. All sorts of executives from Shell, Esso, the usual suspects, in fact, calling for an end to fossils and renewable energy, which is quite encouraging in many ways.
Yeah, indeed. And certainly in the time that I've been working as a climate and energy campaigner, some of the strongest allies that we've had have been ex-industry players. It's like they've realised after a while the impact that their industry is having, and they've sort of had a bit of a come-to-Jesus moment, if you like, you know, where they've determined that they need to undo all of the bad that they did in their professional lives, and they're bringing their experience to bear. But it is only, I mean, while they're outside the tent, they're only able to be so effective. It is great to see. However, it doesn't really seem to be shifting the dial on politics because, you know, we have the major fossil fuel companies continuing to lobby parliaments directly and clearly getting what they want, you know. We see small shifts in the dial at a domestic level, but then we see the big dollars are always going to the corporations, and that's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, well, in fact, on that point, we all miss Meg O'Neill desperately from Woodside, but she's been replaced by a woman called Liz Westcott, who seems to have just adopted the same principles, but they now say that their Browse proposal in Western Australia should go ahead because the government is so far off track anyway in meeting its net zero target that it will make no difference. That's their argument. It's an incredible argument, but they say that because they're years behind in reaching their net zero target, our little Browse proposal will make so little difference, we just need to go ahead.
Yes, and this is, you know, I mean, hardly surprising from a company that has, like, a long history of appalling environmental misconduct. So they've clearly, you know, demonstrated and stated over and over again that the environment and the climate is the least of their concerns. You know, so it's hardly surprising that they're going to advocate for their business. You know, you can't shout at a snake for biting you. It is a snake, you know. So it is really on the government to stand strong and recognise that the interests of their constituents and their population over the interests of business. And that's what we're not seeing happening. So the government really has to be the gatekeeper when it comes to either accepting the narrative from the fossil fuel industry or, you know, accepting the best interest of Australia as a whole and, of course, their responsibility to the global community in terms of Australia's climate emissions, both through our own direct use and also through export. So, you know, I'm not surprised. However, one thing that the Australian government does seem to be overlooking is there's been some initiatives taking place in the European Union around reporting methodologies for methane output, and that's true of gas and coal, for any of the companies exporting fossil fuels to the European Union, they will be required to be directly monitoring and measuring their methane output. And rather than in Australia, we currently just estimate We don't have any direct monitoring of methane emissions, whether fugitive or, you know, direct. And it will be a requirement from the first day of next year that any companies with a contract more recent than the 4th of August, I think 2024, must be able to show that they're directly reporting their methane output. Australia exports to several countries in the European Union, and it's going to be interesting to see how those new measures impact our import industry, and I'm not seeing any recognition of that at the federal government level or in any of the state governments around Australia. So I think this is going to come as a bit of a shock to Australian export industry, like fossil fuel exports, when it actually kicks in. And I'll be interested to see if they extend that that restriction to all fossil fuel contracts, not, you know, without having that kind of cut-off date of the 4th of August 2024. So it's going. There are big changes happening at the international level, and Australia is just not keeping up. We're not responding appropriately, where we're not responding in real time. And it's, I think it's going to come to bite these companies down the track, and the responsible government, okay, so if the government isn't going to stand in support of the best interests of the Australian population, the climate as a whole, our environment, they could at least start to prepare these companies for what's coming down the pipeline, that is more stringent reporting requirements, lower emissions. They're just not doing that. So they're really not doing anyone any favours.
And how does that comply with that decision of the International Court last year that the countries had an obligation to prevent climate harm?
Indeed. And I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm really not in a position to make comment on that. It'll be interesting to see that tested in Australia. Another, you know, there's a few things. There's also in New South Wales, they passed the Climate Change Net Zero Futures Act last year. And basically that requires that, it says that any approvals for projects that run counter to or that prevent New South Wales specifically from meeting their emission reduction target commitments is questionably legal or illegal, and that hasn't been tested yet either. So there are some really interesting decisions being made in courthouses that, again, will have flow-on effects. But it's just a matter of how they are tested in courts, whether they're tested in courts, and then how they're tested in courts and what the judgments are. So I'm looking forward to seeing some of these some of these major projects being tested in courts and see how that plays out.
And of course, our biggest export polluters don't count their Scope 3 emissions at all, which are the ones that their users create by using their product. So that comes back to what you say, though, about what's happening now in Europe with methane.
That's right. And then more than that, many projects, particularly retired and abandoned projects, the emissions from those projects are not even being acknowledged at all. They're not being monitored. They're not being reported into the National Carbon Accounting. They're just, you know, basically overlooked. If we didn't have satellites flying over Australia and testing the methane from, you know, key emissions points nationally, we would have no, you know, handle on how much is, you know, how much is the overall emissions picture nationally. So, yeah, there's so much underreporting. There's so much poor measurement, let alone mitigation of these emissions. And it's, you know, it's incredibly frustrating because methane is, and I've, you know, anyone who has heard me on your show before will probably be sick of hearing me say 84 times more polluting to the climate than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. If we want to make deep cuts to our climate impact today, methane is the quickest and easiest way for us to do that. And the fact that we're not even bothering to monitor it adequately is a deep shame on Australia.
Well, their solutions, I mean, we know that the Chevron Gorgon proposal was approved on the basis of burying their head in the sand, of sequestration of CO2, but they haven't been able to achieve that. I mean, everyone claims that's one of the possible solutions, yet the Gorgon apparently is the biggest polluter of CO2 and presumably methane as well in the country, based on the fact that they haven't been able to live by their promise in the first place.
No, that's right. And I mean, you know, people have been saying, experts and certainly, you know, energy activists have been saying for years, anyone who's paying attention has pointed to the failures of CCS. There are really no projects that have been able to capture carbon to the extent that they have promised. And so it was always going to be a nonsense. We can not pretend that we're surprised now. What can I say? I mean, it was never going to be a solution. It really is just a way for them to write themselves a blank check to continue to produce emissions, and very disingenuous if they think that's going to be any kind of mitigating solution for the greenhouse gas output.
And, of course, we all know that a couple of weeks ago our Prime Minister stood up in front of a conference of the Western Australian resource industry and promised them he would not put a tax on gas. And in fact, he said word for word what they'd been saying for the last several months before, that it would stifle investment and all the usual crap. That was a bit of a setback as well.
I mean, it was widely tipped that we all would have been surprised if he had actually backed it. However, it is also, I mean, it's such a popular policy. There's so much popular support for it. And it's interesting, Kevin, because it's brought together the people who don't have a problem with fossil fuels and just want to see Australia financially benefit from the production of gas, and then those of us who realise that that we need to start putting some restrictions on the gas industry. We need to start sort of applying the thumb screws. We need to start winding it back. I mean, it's really kind of brought everybody together. Whether you love fossil fuels or you hate them, you love a tax on gas. 25% is a very conservative amount to put on fossil fuel exports. Certainly, you know, the 78% that Norway is levying has been held up in contrast, and it really wouldn't have made that much of a deep cut to the companies themselves. It would have been an enormously popular policy. If Anthony Albanese had actually just had the guts to back this in, it would have, I reckon, gone a long way to securing another term for Labor at the next federal election, and that he capitulated to the gas industry and he's done that at one of their luncheons, will not be forgotten by the Australian public. And I think that he has made a really, really bad call politically as well as economically and, of course, you know, for climate.
Mm. And, of course, from our point of view, it's a double problem because, one, you want them to be taxed and pay the right taxes, but we also want less and less gas being used at the same time, don't we? I mean, that's
exactly right. I mean, my concern about using fossil fuel industry as a tax boon, well, certainly we should tax these companies and not, we should have always taxed these companies and not let them basically walk out with 94% of the profits offshore, leaving very little benefit, economic benefit to Australia. For all of the damage that they cause as well, you know, and very little security for cleaning up the mess that they've left. It's just been this real tension between taxing them, but then the risk that we become economically reliant on that tax. My personal position is that we should always have treated this industry, recognise the damage that this industry does and levied against. Instead of having a goods and services tax, have a bads and nuisances tax, essentially. Have a tax on the industries that cause damage such that we have enough money to pay for the damage that they're doing. I think at the very least, that feels like sensible economic policy and fiscal responsibility. So instead of us seeing this as being an economic benefit to Australia, recognising the environmental and climate detriment to Australia that these industries cause, and find some way to levy against them the sorts of costs that governments are already starting to pay for the damage that is caused by fossil fuel industry that's showing up in increasingly severe climate events.
Yeah, and in fact, we're going the other way, of course. We've got we've had the recent approval of a gas project in Corio, and that was followed up by a massive fire a couple of days later with the same company, of course. But also recently, the state government, which has been pretty anti-gas for a fair while, has seems turned it on its head, and it's approved the Otway Basin offshore project, which no doubt will cause massive problems out in the marine life.
Yeah, that's right. And so I'll step back to Viva, because, I mean, not only has the Amplitude...
Viva is the company at Geelong, of course.
Right. So not only has Amplitude Energy, you know, been approved to do another drill out in the Otway Basin, which is awful, but
Hello.
Are you there? Sorry about that.
Yeah, you disappeared for a second.
Yeah, my headset just died. So sorry about that. But the state government has also given approval to Viva to roll out the offshore gas storage unit, which has been enormously unpopular with the local community, particularly, you know, people who are in the front line of Viva's existing operations, hear the alarms that go off every time there's a leak or something goes wrong. People in the local community complain about the ongoing smell of gas. So there have been deep concerns about Viva as being a responsible operator in the area for their existing infrastructure, and to now give them a permit to roll out the floating storage and regasification unit in Corio Bay is just absolutely appalling and unnecessary. You know, like as Victoria's gas demand declines, there is no solid argument for this project to go ahead. Not economically, not environmentally. It's not in the best interest of the community. If there is a leak, if there is a breach of that project, of the gas storage unit, there is a risk of immediate health impacts for the community and even widespread deaths through suffocation if there is a, you know, big leak out of that project. So... And standard practice is that a floating gas storage unit is at least 3 kilometres away from the nearest community centre or nearest household, and it's around 200 metres away from nearest household. So, so there's so many things wrong with it. And then when the breach occurred and the, you know, the fire broke out at the refinery, it really highlighted what the community had been saying about Viva being a dodgy operator and not being able to really properly manage what is very, very complex, volatile infrastructure. So all of that is, you know, is bubbling away for the people and really sort of in the faces of the people of Geelong, but also should have been a proper wake-up call for the Victorian government to really rethink its capitulation on some of the really impressive, like profoundly impressive gas reforms that it has implemented over the last few years. And then for them to go on and approve Amplitude Energy to drill out in the Annie Field of the Otway Basin and argue that that is required to help. It's going to be, you know, earmarked for Victorian use and East Coast gas use predominantly. But meanwhile, gas use in Victoria continues to decline. People are increasingly electrifying. It's, you know, so we have a gas import unit being approved for Geelong. We have an additional gas drill being approved for the Otway Basin. at a time when Victorians continue to walk away from gas use and the East Coast generally is turning its back on gas use and has been doing so steadily over a number of years. So there is no justification for this. It will most likely end up being gas for export. We will end up with another rig out. And you know, Amplitude Energy is saying, oh, but there's literally nothing to see here. It's a subsea structure. It's going to be under the surface. That's not the point. The point is that whether you can see it or not, it is there, and it's going to continue to be a pollution risk for the local area. It is in a whale migration pathway. It's in an area of the Southern Ocean has seen heat waves and increased pressure from climate impacts and other pollution impacts, and could really use a break, and it really is well beyond time that we started to look at the retirement of this industry wholesale rather than approving a single new project. It's completely outrageous. And for contrast, we have over the other side, in the Gippsland Basin, we've got ExxonMobil attempting to slip out of their obligations to meet the base case for full removal of their old retired rigs. And this is how the fossil fuel industry does. They have it all their way, then they leave the mess behind and walk away. They might cop a fine, but they probably won't. More likely, they will just cop a note from the Australian government saying, would you please do better? And when they say no, then there's no consequences for them. So there's no real incentive for these industries to do a good job. There's so much incentive for them to do the least responsible job they can as operators of incredibly volatile industry. It's just amazing to me the Victorian government has turned its back on some of the most impressive leadership in energy reforms nationally and is starting to capitulate again to fossil fuel interests.
Yeah, although I think we have to admire their dedication to the transition from themselves to themselves, don't we? I mean, they...
Oh, my goodness, you said that so well. Yeah, absolutely. And... who knows, with the state election coming up, governments don't make sensible decisions in the lead up to an election. And this is as true of the ALP as anyone, but sort of perhaps even more true of the ALP is that, you know, you start to see policy decisions that are generally populist and that they think is going to win them votes. And if they think that this is going to win them votes, I think that they've misread the community, because the community has stood up. Certainly the people on the Otway coastline have stood against fossil fuel projects over and over and over again. They've said very clearly that they don't want to see any further fossil fuel projects given approval in their oceans. We've seen record paddle out, you know, like amazing community mobilisation. And still where the governments are ruling in favour of fossil fuels over environmental and community interests.
Well, which brings us back to that wonderful Environment Minister Murray Watt. He has to make a decision later this year on that Browse project we talked about. What are the odds?
I would eat my boots if he doesn't give approval to it. If he doesn't give approval to it, it is because the community and campaigners have made so much noise that it's just politically unpalatable. Obviously, you know, the sensible money would be on not giving approval to Browse. Everything is wrong with it. And, you know, I note that we're kind of running out of time, so I can't really thoroughly go into the detail of that.
We're actually out of time, yeah.
Yeah, but I tip that he'll be giving approval, and I hope that I'm wrong.
Yeah, let's hope you're wrong. Okay, Freya. Look, we'll get to talk again, but thanks for your time this morning. It's been wonderful.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks a lot. Freya Leonard there is the, as you can tell, the energy campaigner with Australian Conservation Foundation. Next week it's Housing on City Limits, and in the next minute or so it's Joe Toscano and Annika's World This Week.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.